Hi, this is Jay Washburn.
And I'm Joe Bendosky.
And you're listening to Start Writing.
And this month's discussion is on word choice. If you've been to the blog, we're going to be covering the articles that talk about wasted words, parts one and two, and part three that actually hasn't been released yet.
And I just have to make a comment. I'm going to compliment Joe here, but Joe is really good at this. He's a man who doesn't mince words. Is that the right expression?
Yeah.
He's just really good at this, and I've learned a ton from Joe regarding this subject, and so this is a good one to listen close on.
So this first one we're going to talk about is weak verbs. And a weak verb is essentially when you're using two verbs when one will do. This is not adverbs. You're familiar with that. Weak verbs usually come in the form of had, had been, and was, followed by an ing verb. These are your big weak verbs. And so I have some really interesting statistics for you here, and that is that if we assume the average novel is 80,000 words, and if the author is using these weak verbs, had, had been, wasing, they can account for an average of 10,000 words extra in the novel. Now, if you're familiar with chapter lengths, that's an extra four chapters that are literally just fluff, right? And if I told you I was going to put in four filler chapters of just nonsense just to hit my word count, everyone would think I'd crazy. But that's exactly what happens when you're using these weak verbs, is you're literally filling out four extra chapters of words wasting time. They don't do anything. Now, here's the really interesting thing. If you've heard of the Story Grid podcast, there's a very, very famous editor named Simon Coyne. And he will actually talk about, as he's editing his big projects, he will flag each plot point, and then he'll highlight everything in between as a way of measuring pacing in a very statistical level between plot points. And it's all about the word count in between those two plot points. And he says, I think it's 1,200 words, is you don't want to go more than that. And if you're filling out large chunks of your novel with these wasted words, these weak verbs, then you are slowing the pacing, right? To the amount of four chapters for your entire novel of just pace being slowed down. So it is a big deal, you know. I mean, a lot of people say, you know, it feels like I'm nitpicking when I attack authors for these things. But what we're looking at is the total word count and how much is being slowed down by just not being very efficient in between your plot points. Okay, so here's where things get interesting. So had been is what we call the past perfect. And in writing, we use when you're writing in past simple, which is the most common way to write narrative, the past perfect is then how you refer to something in the past tense within that. So you can't literally cut all of these out, but there are writers who tend to kind of frame everything in that past perfect instead of writing in the past
simple. But you should try to cut them all out.
well, we're going to talk about instances where you're going to use them, instances where they should be cut, and shortcuts where you'd need a lot of them. So here's my example, right? If you've got a whole paragraph that's all past tense, and you're like, okay, then I'm going to have to use the past perfect in all of these sentences to make sure it's clear that it's past. But there's a way around that, right? We can use what's called a frame. And so a frame, what that does is establishes a flashback up front and ends it on the end. So if we use the example, he recalled how drunk his flatmate had been last night, and it dawned on Brody that Leroy would be up by now, grumpy and belligerent. Now, there's a lot of problems with this sentence, right? And first of all, we start off with he recalled. That right there is a part of a frame. That has now told the reader this is a memory of the character. So we've started a frame, which is not a bad thing, right? Then we have how drunk his flatmate had been last night. Now we've used the past perfect in combination with the frame. And so that's redundant. We actually only need one of those, right? And then if we go on, and it dawned on Brody that Leroy would be up by now. And by now is what closes the frame. So in this one sentence, we've used both techniques, right? Now, because it is just one sentence, we would actually probably cut out the frame and just use the past perfect. Frames, you're usually going to want to use for bigger chunks of flashbacks. So if you've got a whole paragraph as opposed to just one sentence, then the frame is a good way to go. And so if we were to read this with a frame and not the past perfect, it reads like this. He recalled how drunk his flatmate was last night, and it dawned on Brody that Leroy would be up by now, grumpy and belligerent. Again, here the frame is excessive, right? Because it's just the one sentence.
So, and just to emphasize, how drunk his flatmate had been last night, as opposed to how drunk his flatmate was last night.
And, right.
And that's shifted by the he recalled right at the beginning.
Right. So if we take out the frame, we are going to have to use the past perfect, and that's the example Travis just read. His flatmate had been drunk last night, and it dawned on Brody that Leroy would be up by now, grumpy and belligerent. So here we've pulled out the frame, and you could even pull out by now as well, and just say that on Brody that Leroy would be up, grumpy and belligerent, right? And so you can...
Joe does this all the time where he looks at a sentence, he's like, no, those two words right there, get rid of those. He'll find it in every single sentence. Yeah. But no, it's good. This is awesome.
Yeah, yeah. And so you can see there's a lot of different ways to write it. But again, the frame is really good for big chunks. And for single sentences, you just want to use that past perfect, right? Because what we're looking all for here is the total number of words it's taking to communicate an idea. Right, and we're trying to reduce that as much as possible. Now, with the wasing, right, a was ing verb, usually you just want to convert this to the past simple. And so I was running, just I ran, right? Now, there are a few examples where you're not going to want to kill your ing verbs, because when you're using a complex sentence, you can, using the ing verb actually saves you a redoubling on the subject, right? And so here's an example of that. He climbed the ice wall, fighting the cold in his fingers. Now, because it's a complex sentence, I have used an ing verb, but the comma means I don't need to use was there. Whereas,
okay, yeah.
If I don't use an ing verb, then what happens is I have to restate my subject. It would read, he climbed the ice wall, he fought the cold in his fingers, right? And so it's just one extra word, but again, you know, what we're looking at is what happens when you have all the extra words in 80,000, yeah, you know, words.
But again, the ing verb is not the problem. It's the was that can come before, but you can use it with that comma.
Yeah, so the problem there is not necessarily the ing verb, but when it's preceded by that was, it usually just can be converted down to simple. Now, for me, I have a lot of tools. Like, I've got Pro Writing Tool, and I can tell it, find every was, and it will find every was. And there are some instances where you use was, but if it's was ing, then I can just delete it, convert it to a past simple, and fix that right away. You can do the same thing with, like, a had and a had been, and you can just, you know, I mean, it's a really easy way to clean that up. You know, with Pro Writing Tool, I have like a set that I can just implement right away. But you can do a similar thing if you're just writing a Word doc. You just do Control Find and hunt these down, right? And again, you need context with the had beens and whatnot, because if it needs to be past tense, then you need to be using that past perfect. But you can also kind of look at it, be like, do I have like 4 or 5 sentences in the past perfect? Maybe I'll just use a frame instead.
Yeah, I like that strategy.
You got anything to add?
So before we go to the next section, I just wanted to, I'm trying to remember this from like grade school, but these are called linking verbs, right? So I remember memorizing am, is, are, was, were, be, being, been, have, has, had, do, does, did, shall, will, should, would, may, might, must, can't, could. So, like, these are all, I think, in a way, like, they're verbs of being, but you look at the two words that you had, which were fighting and climbed, like, there's action in those verbs, whereas all those linking verbs, they're just kind of to be, like,
right.
Like they don't do anything. And so if you can switch to the
hence
action
the term,
that's what
weak
you want
verb,
to do.
Right?
Yeah.
They're weak. They don't carry a lot of weight. And they don't communicate the narrative. They just are essentials in English, which is why we kind of want to cut them out as often as possible.
And more often than you think is possible, actually.
So, All right. What we're covering now is going to come from redundant words, which is part two in the Wasted Words series. And the thing about redundant words is it's not quite as clean cut as the weak verbs. Like with the weak verbs, you can just put it in your cert find all and go through them one by one and kind of fix them. Whereas redundant words, they kind of require a closer look at the meaning of the words themselves. So if we take a look at this sentence, and I have changed maybe a name to a pronoun, but all of these sentences I have pulled from best-selling authors. So I'm pointing out that they do this too, right? They do this too. And so here's our first sentence. He gently caressed her cheek. Well, gently is included in caressed. That's what caressed means. It's a gentle touch. And so that adverb is just redundant there, right? And so we can even roll that back more, and everybody's heard about the adverbs, right? We can say he gently touched, and we say, well, then you just use caressed, right? That's cutting out the adverb. But when we say gently caressed, then it's redundant because a caress is gentle.
So I can hear someone arguing that I need gentle in there because I need to emphasize. And I think there are times when you need to emphasize, but a redundant word is not the way to do it.
Like,
have another sentence in there describing the caress or some other action.
Agreed. Yeah. If you want to go
deeper.
Double
up on that. Yeah.
If you want to go deeper, you explain more. You don't use the adverb in that redundant way. But not only that, but I think any author who's going to argue for that sentence is thinking too much about it and not taking it from the reader's point of view. Mm. From almost any reader's point of view, that's just redundant. I don't think any reader is going to get the extra subtlety the author went into picking that together. You know, I think if that author wants to communicate that to the reader, he has got to explain more. You use a metaphor, right?
So, and also gently, adverbs in general we're supposed to avoid. Like,
right.
That's a solid rule that we should stick to. That's correct.
Yeah, right. And so the idea behind avoiding the adverb is just trying to find that stronger verb. You know, going back to what I just said, gently touched, right? Well, the adverb, you know, is doing work there, but the only reason you're using it for the extra work is because your verb sucks.
Yeah.
If you get a better verb, you don't need the adverb. And so the general rule with adverbs is kill them off and get a better verb so you don't need them. Now, we will talk about J.K. Rowling because she does interesting thing with adverbs.
Oh, really?
And it's impressive.
Wow.
Like, if you can adverb like J.K. Rowling, go crazy.
Don't go crazy. Go light. You can use it, but go light.
well, you'll see. Once we go into J.K. Rowling, you'll understand.
Okay.
The next example is the room was lit only by the skylight above. Well, skylights are above. That's where they go, in the ceiling, right? Not only that, but within this narrative, they were in the room and we already had seen the skylight in the ceiling. Mm. So there's a narrative context, right? Like, you know, if it was a skylight below would be important because that's a contradiction to where it would usually be, right? And so, you know, there's a little...
Maybe they're standing on the roof.
Yeah, standing on the roof.
Okay.
Right. But, or fighting in a helicopter, you know, whatever. But, and so the example three is they laid it down on the table. Again, this is very similar to the skylight one. Laid it means down. You lay things down. You don't lay things up, right? And so again, there is a definite redundancy here, but it is subtle, and you've got to really just kind of watch this as you go through, or have a good editor who will do that for you.
And again, so he's taken one word out of each of these sentences, but that adds up over a 50 or 100,000 word novel.
Exactly.
It's a lot of words.
So, okay. And so the ironic member of the redundant word family is again, right? The interesting thing is that a lot of writers, you write again because it's happened again. And that makes sense. The thing is, the reader knows it's again because they read the first instance of it. So you're not actually giving them new information with this word. You're just tacking it on there because that's how you speak. Right, but it doesn't give credence to the experience, you know, of the reader there. You're like, I know it's again. I read the first time. but there are situations where you can use the word again, and it does add new information to it. I was reading Chuck Wendig's Invasive, and there's a moment where his main character's on a case. She's doing an investigation, and her boss is calling her to get an update. And so the chapter opens, and a few things happen, and then her phone rings. She looks down, and she's like, it was the director again. She hung up, right? Well, actually, I think it said it was the director. She declined the call again. Well, this is the first time we saw her decline the call, but again tells us this is a repeated behavior taking place before the scene. She is repeatedly
she's frustrated
declining these calls, and so it lets the writer start deeper into the scene, but still communicate this repetitious behavior that's taken place beforehand. And so the word again in that situation carries new information. So really well done.
Yeah, that's cool. I like it.
There is also another use for again, and that's if you're trying to lamp something. So a lamp is when you want to work really hard to draw attention to something. Usually, if you have something that stands out as odd and funny, you make sure that you point out to the reader, this is odd and funny, I know, and now we're all in on whatever's going on here, right?
You don't have an example of that, do you?
No, it's a bigger discussion. I didn't want to go into it. I imagine a fair number of people are familiar with the lamping technique. So like I said, I didn't want to go into it during this episode.
But by lamping, you just mean like spotlighting. Shining light, like pay attention to this right here.
Let me see if I can think of a quick example. Oh my gosh, we do this in...
I can just see it being used poetically where you said like again and again and again. Like... Mm-hmm. Using that word to create some monotony for the reader.
Yeah. Oh, the most common redundancy, and I do this in my own writing, is and then. Now, the real problem with and then is that it's grammatically correct. And is technically the conjunction.
Wait, so are you saying we should get rid of and or then?
Either one. You can get rid of either one, and we'll talk about that. But people use them together. And then, not and, comma, then. It's and then as one statement, right? People will write that, and then. And
so the bad example you have is, just give me 10 minutes, and then you can leave.
Right? So, I mean, it flows.
And but, then.
Right? So then is an adverb, and is a conjunction. So grammatically, that's correct. But linguistically, they both function as conjunctions. So linguistically, in the actual meaning of the words, it's a double conjunction.
Okay.
Right?
Can see that.
And so you usually will want to cut one of those two out, right? And the sentence flows the same way, right? If we say, just give me 10 minutes and you can leave. Just give me 10 minutes, then you can leave. It is the same, right? Mm-hmm. And we've just slashed that. Like I write and then from time to time. I have to go back and slice them out. So again, the beauty of the and then is you can just do a find all, right? And you can track those down really easily.
That's awesome.
So another issue very similar related to that is starting a sentence with then. Well, if you have a period, that's basically what it means. This happened, period. Meaning that then, after the statement that is here in this first sentence, is followed this statement. That's exactly what the period means. So starting a sentence with then is redundant with the period you have used before.
So do you never start a sentence with then?
No, there's no reason to. Why?
I don't have an argument.
No, I mean, I'm not saying that I don't write it that way, but I do kill them
go back
in the editing.
Delete them all. Man, I love how judicious you are with every word. I think it's awesome.
So
it's surprising, but it's awesome.
So, okay. And then the next point of redundancy, these are not specifically, well, I guess they are words because it's writing. Everything's words. But this is not like, you know, really looking at words. This is what's called a narrative redundancy. And I imagine that anyone who's involved in writing at this point has seen Aaron Sorkin's, at least the commercial for his screenwriting class, where he tells you, you know, one of the golden rules of storytelling is you don't tell the audience something they already know. and he's a screenwriter, so there's a little bit of leeway there. The average TV show is 45 minutes. The average movie is 90 minutes. The average novel is 8 hours. So there's, you know, and not only that, but, you know, people will watch a movie at once, a TV show at once. They will read a novel over the course of a month, right? That's, I think that's the average for most people.
Really?
There are people who will knock out, you know, a book in a day or a weekend and stuff. You're really heavy readers. But the average reader, you're looking about a month for them to knock that out. So the idea of not telling the audience something they already know is not as hard-lined in fiction. Mm. And so in this next example that I'm going to bring up, I'm going to point out that the narrative is that – so I'll read you the example so you have some context. She struggled against the ropes, then felt her daughter, Amy, at her feet, her little baby. So the woman is tied up, and they've taken the daughter with her as well. And she's referring to her – we get the name and that she's her little baby. Well – in the previous chapter, we were at the house when they were kidnapped. We got the age of the daughter and the name. And so tacking those on in this sentence is redundant because those chapters are just back to back. Unless you set down the novel and walked away for a month, you're not going to have lost this information. Mm. And it's just, it's a narrative redundancy.
So you're saying take this out.
Yeah. Take out Amy, take out her little baby, because we have that information, right?
So I might argue to leave this in that it reflects the character's thoughts.
I see what you're saying.
So she thinks, as you know, this is my little baby, this isn't my daughter, this isn't a child, this is my little baby. And I can see that kind of echoing that sentiment in the character's mind. Now again, I haven't read the rest of the story around this, but
right.
Anyway,
well, I think you have a valid point there too, but at least you would cut out Amy.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah, actually, definitely.
Okay. So I'm gonna, if you look here, I'm jumping down and I'm gonna come back.
Okay.
Okay. So another narrative redundancy. We have this sentence: Eric walked into the house, taking his sunglasses off as he did so. Taking off his sunglasses as he did so. Well, as he did so is communicated in the fact that those two statements occur in the same sentence. That means that they're occurring together, right? If we put a period, Eric walked into the house, period, he took off his sunglasses, then he does one, then another. Mm-hmm. But in this sentence, they're connected with a comma. Eric waltzed into the house, comma, taking off his sunglasses. That means that as he walked in, he took them off. That's the way the sentence is structured. And so adding as he did so, it's just redundant. That's the way the sentence was written, that he was doing those two things together. So there's that redundancy there. And then if we go up, I'm looking on the blog, communicating to Travis here, if we go up.
Actually, this is a good time to mention this. So if you'll go to josephbendosky.com, and he has two posts that are titled Redundant Words.
Well, one is the biggest pacing mistake writers make, and that's Wasted Words Part 1.
Oh, sorry. So, yeah, Google Wasted Words, Joseph Bendosky, and you'll see two blog posts that have all the stuff we've been reading through.
Yeah, all that we're talking about, all the examples are up there. And so this last one is from Dean Koontz's novel Watchers. And this is, again, an example of a narrative redundancy, but it's done well because of how he approaches it. Now, I don't have it quoted here because it spans like four pages, right? So some spoilers here. In Watchers, there's a guy, I think he's with the NSA or the FBI, and then there's a sheriff, and they're tracking this creature that's been killing people throughout this area. And the sheriff is tracking it because there's been a bunch of murders in his district, and the NSA is tracking it because it's this government experiment that's gotten out, and he needs to bring it back in. And so the NSA guy, even though he's friends with the sheriff, he cannot share any information with him. But as the story's gone on, we've gathered bits and pieces of what kind of research they were doing and where it was doing and what exactly is going on and different things like this. And so in this scene, the sheriff is having a dialogue with the NSA agent, going over all of that and putting it all together for himself. So there's a lot of redundancy there. But the NSA agent is the point of view character. And as the sheriff begins to list all this stuff the reader already knows and start, you know, putting it all together in one spot, the NSA agent notices some shadow moving in the woods. And so even though his friend's going off on this rant, he's watching this thing as it just kind of moves back and forth. And, you know, he doesn't know how intelligent the creature is, but they know that there's parts of human DNA in it. And so he's wondering...
Oh, this sounds creepy and awesome.
if this thing in the shadows is it, and if it's studying them as they study the crime scene. And so the whole scene is more about the tension with the NSA agent and watching the shadow and wondering what the creature's thinking as it stalks them like this. Wondering if it knows he's watching it back, right? And so that's what the whole scene is focused. And in between, you get these bleeps of dialogue as the guy puts everything together. So, you know, if the reader hasn't put it all together, it's all put together here. And it doesn't feel redundant because there's this tension of this other event going on.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, and so it's really well done. And so that was a moment when I saw a redundant narrative, but it worked well because he put in that tension. And the focus of the scene was that tension.
So I guess the takeaway is just, if you need a redundant summary or review, layer it with something that has its own inherent tension.
Yeah.
To spice it up. That's cool. That's an awesome move.
Yeah, yeah.
So I have a question for you.
Okay.
So we're talking about very nitpicky details. So
yes.
This is the finest grit sandpaper. Like we're not using a chainsaw anymore. We're down to the very minuscule details. And I feel like a lot of time can be lost if we spend too much time on this early on.
Yes.
Do you have any idea, like any strategies? Yes. Can you postpone this till the end?
You need to postpone this to the end.
And how do you, because once you learn how to do this, I feel like the and thens just jump out at you.
In my own writing, like a lot of time I'll write something, I'll go back and I just kind of fix it as I go, right? you know, I don't make it the focus. Like I said, I write and then, even though I think it's the worst thing in the world.
And you'll go back.
So, you know, and sometimes I catch it right then and get rid of it because it annoys me. But, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes if I'm really just in the story, I just kind of let it be.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, in my editing, I have phases that I go through with different emphasis. And this is definitely the last phase because
this is micro.
It is micro. And if you do this before you do, you know, bigger edits like pacing, plot, character, tension, you know, backstory building, dilemmas, action beats. If you do this before all of those different revisions, a lot of your time does get wasted, gets thrown out because this is,
you spend all this time polishing a scene and then you cut that scene.
And then you cut that scene. Or you have to rewrite it from scratch. Yeah.
Which makes it... the phrase murder your darlings, the more you spent polishing that, the harder that's going to be to get rid of when you need to. And so, yeah, it's a struggle for me, actually. It's why I bring it up, to not do the polishing until it really counts.
Yeah.
But the more you can save this for the end, I think, so, the better it'll be.
And I mean, like, it's, you know, I heard Sanderson talking about this once, and he says a lot, you know, when you're learning to write, there's a lot to learn, and you have to do more drafts because there's so many different things to focus on and deal with each at a time. He says, but the more you write, the more each of those things becomes a part of the first draft.
Wow, that's sweet.
Right. And so, you know, like I said, it's hard to split your brain to focus on individual things in a chapter. Particularly if those are working, then you kind of want to be like, well, that's working right now. I need to focus elsewhere. And so that's just a difficult thing. And I mean, every writer's got their way of approaching the writing and revision. But for me, you know, I try to stay focused on a certain task of the revision, you know, whatever. I'd be like, this is what I need to look at, and save this kind of polishing for the end. But on the upside, you know, once you do enough of this polishing, it just becomes a part of how you write.
So I'll tell you a funny story. I used to teach freshmen English, and I taught them what I called the ninja method. And basically I said, I just want you – well, it's funny. I'd show them this funny Jet Li clip where he's like fighting kung fu blindfolded. But then I said, put a blindfold on as you type your essay, and it forces you to not do
edit
a single bit of editing.
Yeah.
And I think if you're really struggling with that, that could like force you to only go forward.
Yeah. Or you could do a dictation because you can't look back on it that way either.
Yeah. But it's funny. I had a student actually, like my third semester teaching the Ninja Method, who sent me just this garbled email and text. And she said, "This is what I wrote in my first draft." So funny.
That is funny.
Anyway, that's just a thought.
I feel like we skipped 2 points here, so I'm going to go back and cover them. First is J.K. Rowling and adverbs.
Oh yeah, I want to hear this.
Okay, so this is not every time she uses one, but the longer she writes, she leans more and more this way. So this is actually this was in an interview or something that she said this, and she was talking about. So this was actually an interview, and she was talking about Petunia Dursley. And she said that on their first date, Petunia Dursley found Mr. Dursley deliciously normal. and this is what makes that adverb so fantastic, is that it's not making small adjustments to the word normal. It's a complete redefining of how it works. I don't know if you'd call it an oxymoron, but it completely redefines on how it works. Like, normal is not what you think of delicious, right? That's like the average, like the mediocre. But here, she frames it with delicious, and that gives you this perspective on how valuable normal is to Petunia, that she finds it delicious, right?
Wow, and I love that.
So if you can adverb like that, I say go crazy, because it's not a fantastic tweaking. It's a complete rewriting of the verb. Or here, I guess it's an adjective, right?
So does she do this throughout?
No, like particularly in the Harry Potter books, not as much. But if you read her Robert Galbraith stuff, you'll see this a lot more.
Okay.
So like I said, it's something she's picked up in her later writing. But yeah, these, like I said, so if you can adverb like J.K. Rowling, then go for it, because it's fantastic to see it at work like that. And then the other point I wanted to bring up is, and I think I covered this like way long time ago in an early episode, and that is just picking the right verb, you know. And we talk about not using an adverb and finding a better one, but even, you know, going beyond that. So the example I read once was of a train wheel spinning, right? And you could say that they spin, you could say that they turn, or you could say that they whirl, right? But if you go back to childhood, right, when your parents read you these books about the little engine that could, they give you the train sound, chugga, 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 chugga. And out of that, we have this word that means to turn or to spin called churn, right? And so it's not just the visual of what's happening, the spinning of the wheels, but it goes deep into childhood, connecting to that sound of a train wheel that you had there. Well, most of those are really good. Churn is fantastic because of just how it connects to the action, to the sound, to childhood. It's just a powerful, powerful verb for that action.
I like it.
All right. So the last thing we're going to talk about are what are called filtering words. And these are words that kind of create a distance between the reader and the narrative, largely because it's putting in human perspective when we don't have that in our own life. So I'll give you the list right now, and it's watch, look, think, see, hear, listen, touch, feel. And the reason we want to take all of these out is because if we go to the narrative and we're in the POV character, if there is a sound in the narrative, he heard it. So you don't have to say he heard. If there's a sound, he's the POV character. We know they heard it. That's how it's in the narrative, right? It's the same thing, like to say he saw something or he watched something. But if it's the narrative, then it's because he saw it or he watched it. That's how POV works, right? If there's a thought, it's his. So you don't need to say think, right? Now, these words are fine in dialogue, but when you're in the narrative itself, you know, it's adding a layer of perspective that's just wasting a word, right? Because if these things are felt, it's because he has touched them, right? And so that's how those filtering words work and to watch for. And again, the great thing about them is you can do a search all on them and track them down and pull them out. All right. As always, our website is startwriting.space. You can check out the blog on that website, or you can go to josephbendosky.com and the blog. There are blog posts there as well. Our email is pleasestartwriting@gmail.com. And leave us a review of the podcast if you like it, or tell a friend, you know, like it, share, you know, whatever.